Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I've got filmmaker Ashley Cahill with me. Hey, Ashley.
Hey.
All right. So Ash is in London. I'm in LA. So this is on Zoom. So if you have complaints about audio quality, just blame the Zoom Corporation. But it's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we just talked a good long while. The podcast before this one, you can hear all about Ashley and his film First Person, a film about love. I got to say, I love that film. Proud to say it was at Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2019, where it won Best Feature Film, Best Director of a Feature Film, Best Actress in a Lead Role, and Best Production Design. So I got to admit, it's even for a, you know, an indie festival, it's rare we get a four winner, you know, a four award winner. So bravo, golf clap.
Thank you.
And this podcast is not about Ashley's film at all. And if you want to learn more about that film and his career, listen to the podcast before this one. This one is a four questions episode where Ash will answer favorite films of all time, an underrated film, an overrated film, and a lesser known film that people should seek out. And I'll just let you answer. You want to tell me your favorites?
No. Why don't we do the other three first, and then we'll end on the favorites.
I love it. Go for it.
All right. Well, let's start with the overrated film.
Yes.
Now, I'm only allowed to pick one, right?
I always joke. There's no one has a whistle. There's no black and white shirt.
No. I'll say the runners up, and then I'll think. Now, I'll admit, I knew that we were having this interview like a month ago. I started thinking about this question about 20 minutes before we had the last interview. So I haven't really thought it through. And I know that tomorrow, I'm just going to do this disclaimer for everything. I know tomorrow I'm going to go, fuck, I should have said that movie. That will definitely be the case when it comes to my favorites or the little scene movie. Might not be so much the case with the overrated. It might be the case with the underrated. The overrated, so I'm just going to say this about overrated films in general. I think the obvious ones, which I won't bother with, are things like Titanic, Crash, you know, films that have won awards that everyone now has gone, I think that's pretty overrated, don't you? We were being pretty stupid giving Chicago Best Fucking Picture, right?
Okay. Yeah, we were just impressed. We were impressed at the moment.
Yeah, or we felt bad, or the person was dying, or whatever the fuck. There's a lot of those, so I'm not going to bother talking about them. I was watching Philadelphia on television yesterday. I thought, Jesus, this is shit. So I could talk about that, but I don't think that's that rated anymore. You know, like there's certain films that were rated at the time that people don't rate anymore. I think Forrest Gump's exceedingly overrated, but most of the people I know also think it's very overrated. So again, and even Tom Hanks was talking about how there's this huge backlash against Forrest Gump. So again, I'm not going to talk about that. So I got it down to two movies, basically. Well, also Dress to Kill I hate. And I almost did Dress to Kill because my underrated film is connected to that. But I'm not going to do Dress to Kill because, again, I think it's very 50-50. Some people love it, the Pauline Kales and stuff, but a lot of people hate it. So I'm not going to do that. So I have it down to two. I have Amarcord, the Fellini movie, I think is exceedingly overrated. And it got a Best Director nomination, famously taking it away from Steven Spielberg for Jaws, which I think is just outrageous. But the movie I'm actually going to do is Eyes Wide Shut. I think Eyes Wide Shut is my pick for overrated piece of shit film that if it wasn't directed by a man called Stanley Kubrick, no one would care about it today. It is the stupidest movie. It is, it's the sets, you know, the fake New York. And I don't subscribe to this Martin Scorsese. Oh, it's meant to feel like a dream and it's not meant to look like New York. I think it's lazy filmmaking that he built these fucking sets. And whereas it worked on Full Metal Jacket to a degree, or it definitely works, yeah, to a degree. And it definitely worked. And I actually think the cityscapes in Full Metal Jacket work better because you know, that whole Bexton powerhouse that they, or whatever it was called, that they broke into after the offensive scenes. That, I think that works really well. I think the whole training scenes, which people prefer in that half of the movie, does not look like Georgia or, you know, or South Carolina, wherever the, you know, boot camp for the Marines actually is. Doesn't look like that at all. It looks like England to me, just because they're running on the other side of the road and they've replaced the signs. The weather is clearly England. The hedges and the hills, it's clearly Kent. So that, you know, but I'm willing to go along with that. But Eyes Wide Shut, because the movie's okay. But Eyes Wide Shut, I just think is so stupid and overrated. I think the whole, like, go back to San Francisco, you gay, you know, that whole scene is, like, is pointless. I think the whole, like, flashbacks in blue of her, you know, like, her being like, oh, and I thought about fucking this guy, and then that sends him on a downward spiral. The movie's just bad. I can't talk enough about how bad that film is, how overrated.
I agree wholeheartedly. I like to joke that Kubrick managed to make a boring film about an orgy. I mean, yes. how unsexy and boring it was is almost unforgivable. Yeah, and honestly, the acting in that film, I like to, in my own mind, as someone who loves Strangelove and 2001 and Barry Lyndon and such, I like to think that Kubrick cast Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, realized they just weren't going to work. And I think he just decided, right? He tortured them on set a bit, making them do every take 100 times. And I don't know. I feel like he knew it wasn't working.
It's possible, but he has a lot of bad actors in his last films. And I like his films, but, you know, I don't think Ryan O'Neill necessarily works that well either. And I love Barry Lyndon. But I think it's more, you know, I don't think Tom Cruise is particularly a bad actor. And I think Nicole Kidman is a very good actor. So I'm not sure I fully subscribe to that way of thinking. I've heard that theory before. Not that he tortured them, but that it's their fault.
Well, not their fault, but I think she's better than him in the film, but I just think they were wrong for it.
They were wrong for the movie. The film shouldn't have been set in the modern day. The book set in the, whenever it's set, 1910 or whatever. I think it should have been set then. It might have been, you know, slightly more taboo that there's an orgy going on in 1910 Vienna than it ever is in fucking 1997 New York. First of all, also, you know what? If you're going to spend longer shooting a movie than David Lean spent shooting Lawrence of Arabia, it doesn't need to be Lawrence of Arabia or Apocalypse Now, but it's got to be more than a fucking kitchen sink drama that, like Eyes Wide Shut. I'm sorry. You can't spend 3 years shooting this film, or 2.5 years shooting, actually shooting it. Well, you know, they hit over 200 days or whatever it was on set and end up with Eyes Wide Shut. That's a fucking joke, and you're pulling one over us, and you are no longer the director you used to be. Of course you're not. It's not just that you're old. And I do think that sometimes, often, Altman obviously managed to do Gosford Park, and, you know, there have been exceptions. But often, when you get old, you're no longer in touch, obviously, and you know, you're not really making very interesting films. Certainly not if you're trying to be shocking or trying to be, you know, out there. It's been a long time since Clockwork Orange, when you were shocking and out there. So by the time you're coming to Eyes Wide Shut, you're no longer with it. But more to that, I remember, and I don't really like Truffaut that much, but Truffaut talks about in one of his letters or books or some interview, somewhere I read it, he talks about how, you know, it's outrageous that directors take time between movies and think that they can just go back to it. Like, no artist or piano player doesn't practice and then just assumes they can play in a symphony after not having played the piano for a long time or not having painted for a long time. So, unfortunately, most directors do have to spend 2 or 3 years sometimes to try and get a movie made. Now, they didn't have to in those days. It was easier. But for Kubrick, who was, you know, a king, who could easily have gone Warner Brothers to make his films whenever he wanted, to have spent, what was it, like 12 or 13 years between Full Metal Jacket and that one, and you've aged. How the fuck are we, you know, to believe that you can make the caliber of movie that you made before? And yes, he researched his films well, and yes, he took time, but actually, you know, 2001 is 68, I think, and Clockwork Orange is 71, and Barry Lyndon is 76 or 5, I think. So it's not that big a jump between those films. And then, you know, the other one, 79, I think.
Or 80. Yeah, but yeah, he was working two to three years in between. He's working on.
Yeah, he's doing the research and he's working on them. And, you know, like, he's there. You know, there's a reasonable gap between Strangelove and 2001. But the amount of research and set building that had to be done into 2001 is understandable. And he still came out in 68. Strangelove came out in 64. It was meant to come out in 63, but they were meant to have the screening. But then Kennedy got killed that weekend, so they postponed it because it seemed a bit callous to be making fun of American imperialism the day that the president gets murdered. But short of that, so it gets pushed to 64, but it's still a 5 to 4 year difference. I don't know. Anyway,
I think that's probably, I'm with you, and I think it's probably why Full Metal Jacket, a full 7 years after Shining. Like, he clearly didn't spend 7 years putting Full Metal Jacket together.
No, and I think it suffers too. I think it's a good movie. I don't think it's a masterpiece. I don't blame, and I love Kubrick. He might be my favorite director. On the set of First Person, we had, it was a joke, but it had a mod of what would Kubrick do? You know, whenever it was like, well, let's not do it again, or let's not, you know, it became an ongoing mantra. Well, what would Kubrick do? You know, but the truth is, I think once you get to The Shining, I don't even rate that film that highly, but, you know, I think it's got some great, great moments and, you know, very famous things. But The Shining is he's gone over the hill there. It's the beginning of the downwards hill. And it's still a better movie than most, but it's not really on the level that four picture window, which is an almost unbeatable four films in a row. And I like Lolita a lot too, so you could make it five films, but, you know, I don't think Lolita's quite on the level of those four. But it's like, and then, of course, he's made masterpieces before that. Paths of Glory is clearly a masterpiece, but it's not in a row. He does Spartacus between them. So it's like, you know, but those films are of a different caliber. I don't know. I even think The Killing is of a different caliber to The Shining and Full Metal Jacket. And that's just, you know, it's a cheap noir. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I agree. Yeah.
But I wouldn't say that they're completely overrated. Whereas Eyes Wide Shut, I think it's just a bad movie.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Underrated, on the other hand. It's between two. I'm sure I could think of others, but right now it's between two. Body Double, the Brian De Palma. If you like porn and if you like music videos by starring Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and if you like films about films that don't really make any sense and terrible makeup on a guy that's meant to be like a Native American Indian, but it also isn't. And if you like girls getting killed with a fucking drill, then what's not to like? This film has it all. Yeah, maybe I will go with Body Double. But here's the thing. I don't think it's quite as underrated as my other film. However, it's a lot better than my other film. So whereas Body Double, I think, is a film that most people hate, but De Palma fans love, and now is getting reevaluated by, you know, the film buffs, the Tarantinos of the world and whatever, Noah Bumbums of the world who like Body Double. This other film is much more a guilty pleasure film, so I'm going to go with this one. So my final choice is going to be Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which I think is a very underrated film. I believe, now, I haven't even researched it. It's been a hell of a long time since I've seen it. I think it stars Tom Skerritt. No, it doesn't star Tom Skerritt. That's a lie. It stars the guy from Maniac Cop.
I pulled it, Tom Atkins.
Yes, that's who it stars. The king of the B-movies, who looks like Tom Skerritt but isn't. That's who it is. It stars him. and it's got a great soundtrack. And my alarm clock is the commercial from it, the Silver Shamrock commercials that they have throughout the movie. It's got the guy from Robocop in it, the guy who runs OCP. You call this a glitch? Him. He's in this. And it's just a really good, cheap, Corman-y kind of horror movie that has nothing to do with Michael Myers. Now, Halloween, the John Carpenter 1978 movie, I think it's 78. Don't think it's as early as 76. I think it's 78. Halloween is obviously a masterpiece, and it's hard to outdo it. And in fact, they never have. And they keep doing these fucking Halloween movies with Michael Myers, and they might as well just be Jason films, which were never good. None of the Friday 13ths are good. Although I do quite like Friday the 13th final chapter, and I quite like Friday the 13th Jason Lives 6, which is also maybe a contender for underrated because it's fucking hilarious and it's very meta. I think it's written by the guy who wrote Scream. I think it's written by Kevin Williams. Anyway, Williamson or whatever his name is, but I don't know. Back to Halloween 3 though, which is more underrated. And it's got a great ending, and it's just really dark, and the masks are so great, and it has nothing to do with Michael Myers, which I think is great. And of course, it's a huge flop because it had nothing to do with Michael Myers. People went to see it, and they wanted to see a guy go around killing naked girls, and they don't. What they get is a huge conspiracy movie that takes place in Santa Mesa, I think is the name of the town off the top of my head, which is a fake town. It's the same town that's in the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and I think it's the same town that's in I can't remember. It's in a few things. It's definitely in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I think it's called Santa Mesa. Anyway, and it's also in Halloween 3. And yeah, I don't really want to give anything away other than, yes, it's cheap, it's hokey, it's corny. I mean, I'm not expecting people to go see it like, oh my God, this guy said it was underrated. It's not rated. So I rated a little bit, means it's underrated. So yes.
Fair enough. And it is a fun move. I enjoy the move you did there of, you know, you named all these, obviously these horror franchises that came out when I was in high school, they all became parodies of themselves. And it sounds like this one, they were aware of it and just went the opposite direction and abandoned Michael Myers, abandoned the silliness of the genre and just went for something else.
They didn't abandon the silliness of the genre.
Okay.
They saw the silliness of the first two and they doubled down on it and they raised it a lot. It's a lot sillier, but it's, you know, it's good. It's got a great ending. I mean, really, the ending is the whole movie. And the masks and the commercial. There's this commercial that's constantly on in every fucking scene. And it's great.
Well, I got to say, it backs up a theory I've had since I was young, which is it's all about the ending. A so-so film that has a wonderful ending. You walk out of the theater saying, I love that film. And if it's great for 90 minutes and then the last 20 minutes suck, you walk out thinking, I didn't like that film.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. And, you know, the guy was, I think the director worked with John Carpenter a lot. He was either, I can't remember if he's an editor or an art director or something. You know, so I think he worked on Dark Star and I think he, you know, he worked on some other things that Carpenter did. So, yeah, I think it's worth having a watch. It's good. All right. So what's the next question?
So the next one can be lesser known?
Lesser seen films. Yes.
Yeah.
So I got two ideas for this one. One is a better movie than the other. One is called The Hill. It's by Sidney Lumet. So already it's a big director. And stars Sean Connery. And I really think people should see this movie. It's very British. Sidney Lumet doing a very British movie. And it's black and white. And it went to Cannes. And I think it's 66, 65, 66. Might be a little later, but it's definitely 60s. It's Connery at the height of Bond. And he was wanting to do something not Bond. And he's not wearing his wig. You know, he's pretty balding, very balding in it. And it's about a prison, an army prison for soldiers during World War II. Not a prisoner of war camp. They're not prisoners of war. They're actually soldiers. And I think it's in World War II. It might not be. It might be Korea. I think it's World War II, but I think it's during combat. I'm not sure. The guy punched his senior officer and got... Yeah, it must be...
Yeah, World War II. Spotted the synopsis. Yeah, North African military prison during World War II.
Okay, so it is World War II, but you don't see combat in the film because it takes place in this North African prison. And it's Sean Connery, the great Ossie Davis is in it in a very early role. It's Sidney Lumet directed it. And I'll be damned if I can remember the name of the guy, the other guy in it. Let me look it up. What's the name of the other
Harry
guy?
Andrews?
Shit, I can't remember his name. Anyway, doesn't matter. Actually, I'll just look him up. The Hill movie. The Hill movie. All right.
And I mean...
Oh, yeah, Ian Hendry. That's the name of his... Okay, so Ian Hendry... who was also in films like Get Carter and films like that. And he's in a lot of those kind of 60s, 70s films. Very English. I think he thought he was the next Michael Caine or even Michael Caine, because I think he predates Michael Caine slightly, but he never really became that guy. And he's very good in this. He's always a bit evil and nasty. And he plays a sergeant who's like in charge of drilling them, and he drills one of them to death, and the soldiers want to press charges against him, and it's just a very dark, very kind of brutal movie, and Sean Connery's, you know, kind of leading a mutiny, and it's got a lot of great actors in it, you know, a lot of actors that appear in other things. Harry Andrews is fantastic in it. He's like you know, an actor that a lot of people would recognize in certain films and stuff. So that's one. And I really think a lot of people should see that. And I'd seen it a lot. Again, has a great ending. Really brutal, brutal, brutal ending. And then another one that I thought of, which I've only seen once, and I'd never heard of. And I saw it during COVID. I watched a hell of a lot of Westerns and a hell of a lot of movies. And I stumbled upon this film. It may have been on Criterion Channel. It must have been, because I don't know why we would have stumbled on it, me and my friend. And it's called The Last Sunset. And I wrote a little blurb review of it at the time, which I did for Instagram, and so I'll just read it. It said, I'd never even heard of this film until last week. What a great Western. It's not a masterpiece, and it's a little hokey, but there's a hell of a lot packed into this sucker. I mean, it has everything from cattle drives to Indians to gunfighters, a final duel, quicksand, Kirk Douglas singing in Spanish. What more do you want? Truly a surprising discovery. So if that doesn't sell it, I don't know what will. So yeah, I do remember it. It stars Kirk Douglas and Rock Hudson. I don't know who directed it, but it's... Yeah, I remember being like, man, I gave it 8 out of 10. I thought this, if you like classic Westerns, it's very classic. It's very within the classic genre. And I know that Rock Hudson and Kirk Douglas, they have to team up and they don't like each other. They're planning to kill each other. But they have to team up for some reason. The reason I cannot remember for the life of me, because again, I saw the film once and it was about a year and a half ago. During a time when I watched about 45 fucking Westerns and 360 other films. So I'm having a little trouble remembering, but I do remember that it stood out. I remember there's a quicksand scene, which I wrote about, which seemed ridiculous in a Western. I don't remember this singing in Spanish. I'm glad I put that in there. And I know that Rock Hudson's in it, and he's kind of interesting. He's he's good in it, but the film belongs to Kirk Douglas. And there's a girl in it too.
Yeah, for the Dorothy life, Malone. I don't
remember who she is. Oh, yeah, there you go. That's who it is. Yeah, so those two. Now, if the people listening want my opinion on what the better film is, clearly The Hill is a better film. The Hill is a very good film. It's just that hasn't got the same, for some reason, isn't a very famous film in the United States, probably because it's so English. However, I did see an interview with Woody Allen, and he named it as a lesser seen film that should be seen as well, ironically. And I remember being like, wow, Woody Allen seen The Hill? But I don't know why I was surprised by that. So, yeah. And now we come to my three favorite films, right?
That's okay. Right. But if you need to go over, I don't mind.
Well, I'm not going to go over necessarily, but I will say that there's favorites and then there's favorites that I tell people. And they're not necessarily the same thing. So if I was to be completely honest, and then there's also favorites on films that have influenced me versus films that I actually maybe enjoy more. So I'll just break it down into, if I'm going to be honest, the films that I know very well and have studied and I grew up on because my parents were huge fans, and I think is possibly the greatest films ever made, and I couldn't say are not my favorites, would be, let's say, Godfather 1 and 2, for example. And I count that as one film. I know people go, well, you can't do that. But you can, because when you watch Godfather, you know, spoiler alert, you can't watch Godfather not knowing that Fredo's going to be killed. But he's not killed in Godfather. He's killed in part 2. But when you're watching it, it adds to the pathos of the film and the tragedy of Michael Corleone and so on. So I count that as one giant movie. But what a boring fucking answer. Everyone loves The Godfather, you know. So, you know, I don't want to go. And when I was younger, Lawrence of Arabia meant a lot to me. But I've seen that film so many times, I'm not sure I could sit through it again. You know, there's certain things that it's like now I'm at the stage of what films are within my favorites that I actually would watch. Like, I'm not sure I'm in a hurry to watch The Godfather again. I know that film so well. So I've thought about it in those terms. And then I also, now that I make films and think about films on a professional level, I try and think about movies that also have influenced me as a filmmaker. And I can't really say that Lawrence of Arabia has ever influenced me much as a filmmaker. I don't make those types of films. And even The Godfather, of course, there's moments, and I have copied them. I even copied moments from it in first person. I shot her against the window and she turns around, and I was basically copying where Michael's standing by the window and Fredo's being like, yeah, I'm smart, not dumb like people say, that whole scene in Godfather 2. But on the whole, it's a hard film to really be influenced by because it's so specific. So, with all of that in mind, I'm not going to name those films or, you know, foreign films or things like that. But so I'm going to start with The Long Goodbye. I'm going to put that as one of my, these aren't my three favorites. These are my top 20. But I'm picking three films from my top 20. How about that?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm just going to pick three films from my top 20 that might not be The Fucking Godfather and Lawrence of Arabia and 8.5. Okay. So The Long Goodbye will be one of my selections because I like Robert Altman. And although I might say McCabe and Mrs. Miller is a better movie, but I like The Long Goodbye. If I want to hang out with a movie, I'm going to hang out with The Long Goodbye. I like Elliot Gould in it. I don't like him in everything. I like the L.A. of it, the L.A.-ness of it. I like Sterling Hayden. I think it's fun. Yeah, I like that movie a lot. So The Long Goodbye is going to be in there. I saw it not that long ago in the cinema in 35mm print with Elliot Gould in attendance. And that was fun. It was early in the morning, though, which was less fun. But yeah, anyway. So I like that movie a lot. And then I'm going to say The Wild Bunch, because The Wild Bunch is just a fucking fantastic movie all round. And it's really a faultless film, other than maybe mild, maybe not even that mild, misogynism. But outside of that, it's just a fucking great movie. And I saw it very recently in 70mm at the American Cinematheque. And I took a friend of mine, a girl, to see it. And we've been seeing quite a lot of films. And we actually did like a back-to-back of Westerns. I might have Westerned her out, actually. We did The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly 1 week, and then The Wild Bunch the next week, and then The New Beverly was showing Unforgiven the next week, so we did all three. And I think by the time she got to Unforgiven, she might have been Westerned out. But she loved The Wild Bunch, and I was very nervous that she wouldn't, because it's old, it's dated, you know, it's very male. Women are basically whores in it, or they get shot, or they get called bitch, or puta. I mean, they really don't get a good time in that film. Neither do animals, by the way. I think animals get a really nasty time in that film too. But it's such a good movie, and it's a deep film. It's meaningful, and there's just so much going on in it. It, you know, men pass their time, and what does giving a word mean? And the William Holden character, it was a fucking hypocrite. He's always talking about giving your word and you stick by your man, but we know that he abandoned Ryan, Robert Ryan, and we know that, you know, that they're thinking of abandoning Angel, and it's only at the very end that they decide not to. And the guy who plays Mapache in it's a very famous, not many people know this, he's actually a very famous Mexican director, and I think he won the Palme d'Or, or he certainly went to Cannes. He's like a big artistic, like, Mexican director before the Mexican New Wave, obviously, that now every Mexican director is famous and gets work in America. But this was in the 60s and 50s. And I'm sure, for sure, Sam Peckinpah must have known this. I always want to know what they talked about and stuff. But anyway, you know, it's interesting when directors use directors in films. It's quite interesting, you know. So that's one of my favorite films. That really is one of, that might actually be a top three film of mine, like a genuine top three film of mine. I think it's, anyway, so we saw it in 70mm, and we were quite close to the front. And at first I was like, oh shit, we might be too close. I like being close, but not necessarily in a Peckinpah film with that much editing and that much camera movement. But we got into it. It worked. So that's my other choice. And then my final choice, speaking of directors using directors, it's a close one. I'm not sure which of these two I'm going to pick. I got Rosemary's Baby, which obviously stars John Cassavetes. That's my director using a director thing. But of course, it stars Mia Farrow. Okay. And that movie, I think, is flawless. And I think it's Roman Polanski's best film. I know everyone says Chinatown is. I think they're wrong. I think Rosemary's Baby, as a pure cinema, purely directed film, from a director's point of view, if I'm going to copy a film, if I'm going to steal moments from it and how it's put together, the pacing of it, Rosemary's Baby and the humor is flawless. The benevolence of evil of Rosemary's Baby. I mean, how kind and nice the neighbors are while they're using your body as a vessel for hell. It also, you know, it ties in so beautifully with Get Out, the modern horror masterpiece, you know, which are both about having your bodies used as a vessel against your will. They're also both about what's the word I'm looking for? A people that is...
oppressed people.
Yeah, or oppressed is, or sub, where you're put to the side.
Subjugated.
Yeah, well, no, not subjugated. I'm trying to think of a different word.
Marginalized.
Yeah, marginalized, that's the word. A marginalized group of people. Yes, yeah, so in the 60s, women. And in the now, African-Americans. But it's very, you know, it's you know, and it's all done very kindly, and it's all done with nice white people. And I think those two films are very, I'm sure I'm not the only person who've come up with that concept. I think they're very connected. I know that Jordan Peele is a Rosemary's Baby fan, 100%. It's only now that I'm thinking about it that I'm seeing how many connections there are between those two films. Wow, there really are a lot. But anyway, Rosemary's Baby, I think Get Out is a masterpiece, but Rosemary's Baby I grew up on, and I just think it's just a great film. And all the little touches, the cab, the guy when they get in the cab, it's not a cab, they get in the car waiting for them, and the guy kind of like nods, the driver kind of nods back at camera, or, you know, they hear, it's all those little things. Polanski's really good at doing that. He has those, there's someone, what are they doing? He's drilling a hole. It's a manual drill, though, you know, one of those old-fashioned ones that you have to actually turn. He's drilling a hole. I think he's drilling a spy hole into a door as they're walking past early in the movie. It's like later in the film. It's like in Chinatown. There's a couple of moments where, like, Nicholson shows up at the house and he turns, and the guy's cleaning the window of the car and squeaking. That's what made him turn. And then later on, when he goes back to Mulray's office, the guy's taking the name off the door because he's dead, and you hear it, and he opens the door, and the guy's kneeling, and he looks up and he closes the door again. Polanski's very good at just putting in these little characters in the background, and Rosemary's Baby is full of that. It's all that, you know, and great little lines. It's so many great lines in that film. This, you know, he was in Luther and Albatross, or, you know, oh, there's so many good lines. I can't remember them now that I'm on the spot, but that film's really a great, all of them witches, and oh, it's a great, great movie. The other film, and I steal from Rosemary's Baby all the time. The other film that I steal from all the time, well, this is a bit of a lie, actually. So I'll qualify it first. I actually steal from Taxi Driver way more than I steal from this movie. And I guess Taxi Driver's a better movie, I suppose. It's got a better score, obviously. This film doesn't have a score. And it's better written. It's probably better acted. But if I had to pick one Martin Scorsese movie, it would actually be Mean Streets, not Taxi Driver. There's something about Mean Streets that I keep coming back to. Now, when I make movies, even in first person, I often watch Taxi Driver once, with the sound off often. I'm just watching it for camera movements, because Taxi Driver is still cheap enough. Like, with the equipment he was using, which was more bulky, you could probably recreate a lot of that with cheaper equipment today, small equipment. It's still cheap enough that he's not, you know, if you watch Dolly, it wobbles, you know, in Taxi Driver, it clearly wobbles and stuff. And yes, he's using a Fisher Dolly because it goes up and down as well. But, you know, you're clearly on location. Like the scene where De Niro's talking to Jodie Foster in the room for the first time, where she's like, the cigarette when it goes down, and he's like, God damn, and he walks around her. I know that the cameraman's having to lean back against the wall as he's there, and he's having to pull focus. Like, they're not using movable walls. It's a fucking disaster. The sound is terrible in some scenes. The talking to me scene, the sound is so bad. You can hear all the noise coming out from outside the apartment. So, but that said, it's still a much bigger budget than Mean Streets, which is really low budget and really indie. And it's personal, and it's a hangout movie like Vitelloni or something. It's clearly copying that movie. And I don't know. Although I definitely copy the camera work of Taxi Driver more, I think Mean Streets is a deeper movie. Taxi Driver is a character study. It might be the all-time great single character study of a person, or certainly of a crazy person. Mean Streets isn't a character study. It's a study of a people, really.
Yeah, it's a culture. Yeah, and it's
a culture. It's a study of a culture,
and it's clearly personal to him.
Very personal to him.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it is an important film.
Yeah, and it's
in a lot
deep,
of ways. I'm with you. It is. Film. It is in a lot of ways. It is his greatest because he's not being grandiose at all. He's really telling the story.
And yet, all his flair is visible in Mean Streets.
Yeah,
he has the slow motion. He has the rock and roll. He has the 1950s music and the Genovese Napoletana music that he's also likes that he puts in once in a while. It's a lot more in Mean Streets than his later films, but it's there. He has his film references. There's a Point Blank poster, and they go and see like a Roger Corman movie or something. You know, there's, you know, hey, $5, let's go to the movies. You know, like it's all in there. He has the humor. He's got De Niro and Harvey Keitel. You know, he's got the racism. He's got the things that his films deal with. But even on a technical level, you know, De Niro's entrance into the bar in slow motion to Jumping Jack Flash, I almost think is the most important cinematic moment this side of Citizen Kane, because that starts every fucking slow motion rock and roll moment that Scorsese then perfected later. You know, it almost starts there, but it's also got a roughness to it. Like, the voiceover isn't Harvey Keitel, it's Martin Scorsese talking for Harvey Keitel, but sometimes it is Harvey Keitel. It's like they got Harvey Keitel to do some voiceover, and then Scorsese decided to add more voiceover and couldn't be bothered to bring in Harvey Keitel, which I find fascinating. The opening lines, for example, you don't make up for your sins in the church, you do it on the streets, you do it at home, the rest is bullshit, you know it. That is Martin Scorsese. And then at first you go, well, okay, he's just saying it because it's his film, but then the rest of the film is going to be Harvey Keitel. But it isn't, because the whole part where he's like, you know, the sin, the burning, there's the outside pain and then there's the inside pain of the hell and there's the burning of your soul. And when he's got his finger in the fire and he's burning himself and he's like, you know, but the inside pain's the worst pain. You don't fuck with that pain, you know? And I'm like, but that's Martin Scorsese. You know, and then, but then there is some Harvey. I don't know why I'm stuck on that. Also, there's a lot of unquestioned things. There's unanswered things in Mean Streets. There's the whole, well, first of all, we're not entirely sure about the relationship between, I don't mean their friends or the cousins and stuff. They're not cousins, actually, they're friends. Teresa is De Niro's cousin in that film, and she's sleeping with Harvey Keitel. But we don't. There's something has happened in the movie before the movie begins, and I've even seen Scorsese talk about it, and he doesn't answer it, or he claims not to know, which is fine. I've written films where I don't know the answer, and it pisses some producers off, and I'm always like, why do I need to know the answer? It's the characters that have this fucking relationship. Let the actors figure it out. But I think, you know, something has happened between De Niro and Harvey Keitel's characters before the film begins that has made Harvey Keitel feel guilty. And the whole Francis of Assisi is brought up throughout the film. You know, Francis of Assisi didn't run numbers. You know, that great line. You know, there's all these moments because he's trying to be religious. He's trying to be a better person. And he runs numbers. And he runs, you know, people out of business in restaurants for his uncle, who's clearly a mobster. And he's torn between these two worlds. And he's also driven by guilt, one assumes, or he's driven by wanting to look like he's a better person. It's one or the other. I always thought he was driven by guilt, and I think Scorsese does too. Doesn't mean that he's right, by the way. I don't think just because the director says something, it means it's the answer. It just means it's his answer. But I know Scorsese says he's driven by guilt, but he doesn't know what it is that has made him feel guilty. But my friend, this guy called Adam Riley, he thinks he's driven by wanting to be a martyr and not guilt. That he's driven by, I've picked De Niro, who's a fuck up, and I'm going to help him, and I'm going to be seen as a martyr, and I'm going to try and get him out of trouble with his money that he owes all around town, and specifically with the character of Michael, and this or the other. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting, you know, because there's that thing when they argue and De Niro's like, you never did anything for me, you never done nothing for me, and you know, and he's all crying and upset. And my friend Riley takes that scene and he's like, yeah, you know, De Niro knows that he's being used by Harvey Keitel, which I never looked at before. And I'm coming around now that I'm thinking about it to believing that there is some truth to that. That De Niro's resentment towards Harvey Keitel in that film is that he knows he's being used. And that's why he goes out of his way to fuck up, to kind of rub it in his face. And there's this great line. If I ever were to meet Martin Scorsese, I only have one question for him, which is why? I've never seen it asked in any interview ever. My question for Martin Scorsese would be, why does De Niro say you got what you wanted? And it comes after, right at the end, before the driving, before the shot, before that, in the bar, when Michael comes and goes, what happened to rest? You know, yeah, he's got $40. Where's the rest of it? $10. And he throws it at him. And De Niro goes, oh, this money, you know, $10, it's good for a thing. It's not good enough for you. And then he lights it on fire. You know, I've liked this because I fuck you right where you breathe. And he does that. And then Michael grabs him and De Niro pulls a gun on him. And he's like, yeah, you fuck. Yeah. And he leaves. And then Harvey Keitel grabs a gun from De Niro and it's not even loaded. He's like, you fucking idiot. Were you going to lose that? And the guy's like, oh, it's not even loaded. And then Harvey Keitel goes, we need a car. Let me borrow your car to the bartender because we got to get out of here. And the bartender's like, this isn't good. You guys go to a movie. Don't drive around. Like, don't be somewhere they can find you, which of course what they do. And they end up getting shot. Right there, there's this pause before they cut out of the scene, and De Niro's standing there, kind of, you know, they're all annoyed, and De Niro goes, kind of shrugs and goes, you got what you wanted. And I've never understood what he means by that. And my friend, me and Riley have talked about this scene many a time, and the best we've come up with is that, well, and it took a long time. It took Riley coming to the conclusion that De Niro thinks he's being used and that Harvey Keitel is doing it for martyrdom, that you got what you wanted, meaning you're now a martyr. That's what he means. And he may be right, but I've never understood, and I would like to bring it up to Martin Scorsese should I ever meet him, or I'd like someone else to bring it up to him. But that, you know, that's what makes that line almost makes the movie for me. That moment and that relationship between them, I think is, you know, it's like going back to the Wild Bunch, you know, being right is my business or being sure is my business. You know, it's like there's these moments, you know, it's not the point. It's who you give your word to, you know. That's what elevates these films, these moments. But Mean Streets, I think, is really, I don't know, it works on a different level for me. And I like hanging out with them, so that helps. I like watching the film. I find it funny and fun and backgroundy. But again, if I was to be honest, as a filmmaker, I copy Taxi Driver a hell of a lot more than I've ever copied Mean Streets shot for shot. You know, but then again, Taxi Driver is copying Jean-Luc Godard. So maybe it's right that I pick Mean Streets more. I think it's a more original film. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, all right. I certainly appreciated your list. That's, it's funny. Now I have to, you make me wish I had, you know, 36 hours in a day so I could go back and rewatch some things that I haven't seen for, my goodness, probably since university. But
yeah, I think that's a good, I'm going to throw out that as an LA movie, if people don't like The Long Goodbye, or no, they fuck them if they don't like it. But another very good LA movie, like The Long Goodbye, same period, is Shampoo. And I almost went with that one. But I think The Long Goodbye might be a better movie. At least it had, I don't know. But Shampoo, I think, is a very good LA. Like, when people go, what's your favorite LA movie? I always say Shampoo. Not Chinatown, not fucking Blade Runner. Shampoo is my favorite LA movie. But I'm going to go with Long Goodbye just because I think it's maybe a better movie overall. But yeah, but out of those three that I ended up picking, well, I really picked four because I also picked Rosemary's Baby. I guess Mean Streets is my favorite of the four. Although Wild Bunch is close. But I think Mean Streets, I don't know, there's something about it. I think it's really a fucking good movie. So that's it on those.
And they're all from, I don't want to get us on a final tangent. Kind of got to wrap it up. But
they are all from New Hollywood.
You're picking them from, they're in that wonderful era when the studios had the studio system had crumbled, and Scorsese and, you know, just a handful of people just started really pushing the boundaries.
And yet I'm so bored of that era, and I'm so bored of people talking about that era that, yes, I didn't even think of that. Now that you've pointed it out, I wish I'd picked films from the 80s and 50s. And, you know, because Treasure Sierra Madre is also one of my favorite movies, and it's a top five film. It's definitely a top five. So I could have done that, but I went with The Wild Bunch because I watched The Wild Bunch more recently. If I just watched Treasure, I would have probably gone with that. You're right. They are all from that era. And actually, they're all directors from that era, except for Polanski, who slightly predates it. And he's also European, and Peckinpah, who also predates it. And that's why I don't.
And Peckinpah's his own, he's his own world. He was always the equivalent of an indie filmmaker.
Yeah, and he's a bit like Kubrick. I mean, he does some of his best work in that period, but he definitely predates that period. And The Wild Bunch, as modern as it is in its editing and its violence, is very much a classically made Western. You know, it's not, I mean, it's a revisionist Western, but it's not really like the later Eastwood films, and it's nothing like the spaghetti Westerns. You know, like, I think it's much more of an American Western. It's nothing like McCabe and Mrs. Miller. You know, like, I think he's much more rooted in that kind of Western. You know, I think The Wild Bunch doesn't really feel 1970s. I mean, it's 69. I think the makeup and the color is clearly 60s, just like Rosemary's Baby is clearly 60s. But yes, The Long Goodbye is very 70s. Mean Streets is extremely 70s, and it's Scorsese, and it's Altman, and Shampoo's
And you didn't throw Jaws in there, but it's pre-Jaws, it's pre-blockbuster 70s.
Yes, but Jaws is a top five film of mine. I'm sure, didn't bother throwing it in there. But Jaws is used to be a top three. It's probably a top 10 now. It might have dropped to top 20 because sometimes I think I put Alien above it. But I've been thinking about Jaws a lot. Jaws is like, people, my friends know, almost go like, I'm the Jaws guy. Jaws is I think it's by far Spielberg's best film. I think he's done a lot of great films. I actually like Spielberg. I think he has a habit of ruining his films with his endings. But if you take those away, I think he's made some great, great movies. But I think Jaws is Jaws for Spielberg is a little bit like Do the Right Thing for Spike Lee, where it seems possibly beyond their grasp. Like, they just happen to have made this film that I'm not sure they could make again. And they've made other great films, and I think Spielberg's made way more great films than Spike Lee. But there's something about those films that it's like, oh, it's almost accidentally brilliant, how brilliant you managed to make it.
Yeah, just everything came together.
Everything. And I say almost like Do the Right Thing, because Do the Right Thing, I'm going to give slightly more credit. I prefer Jaws as a movie, but Do the Right Thing's written by Spike Lee, so it's even more his movie. But, you know, it's not based on the source material, and, you know, and it doesn't have fucking John Williams helping you along. But you know, Tarantino recently called Jaws the greatest movie ever made, movie as in blockbuster type movie. And, you know, I don't think he's wrong. I think Jaws, more than Star Wars, more than any of them, is the fucking movie. I think it's so well made. It's so well edited. It's so, the characters and the background actors and everyone, there's not one townsperson that doesn't seem in place. Every line, you know, when am I an islander? You're never an islander. Yeah. All those moments of, you know, that's some bad hat, Harry. Oh, it's what a great movie that is. I easily could have put Jaws in there.
I only mentioned Jaws because I remember talking to you 3 years ago, and I think we compared your lead character in First Person.
Oh, yeah, she's the shark.
She's the shark.
She's the shark. She's a monster. I completely agree.
Yeah.
I know. She is the shark. She is the shark in Jaws.
And once you once you look at storytelling as human beings under threat, right? Most of our story, most of the Bible is just human beings with some threatening presence coming at us. Yeah, I mean, a big part of being human is being aware of danger.
Yeah.
And pure, purely unknown. Yeah, all it lives to do is eat us.
Yeah.
And how do you deal with it?
Is man versus shark.
Yeah. I mean the shark is because the ocean's dark, blah blah blah. Yeah,
talk about all its meanings and yes, and of course.
Yeah. Why the shark is the perfect predator analogy, so because snakes and alligators, fine, they're all scary. But the shark is can bite you in half, and that's kind of special.
Well, and you don't see him.
Yeah.
You don't see it. But really, the shark is a John Williams score. That's what the shark is.
Okay.
Like,
that's right. Because it's an invisible presence. It's just the music. Right.
Yeah. If you didn't have that music, I think that the two John Williams films that, and I think, I guess it's more the case with Jaws, although I prefer it as a film, but I'll give Star Wars its due on production design and on special effects and on myth making. But if you remove his score from those two films, I can't think of any other movies that rely on score as heavily as those two. And there's many films rely on score very heavily, and even other John Williams films, Superman. Yeah, there's plenty. But I was watching the new Top Gun, which I really enjoyed in the cinema. I thought once it got going, I was in it. Great. You know, I love it. But during all the dogfights, all I could think was how much better these dogfights would be if they had the Star Wars score over them that plays during those dogfights, especially in the first one. All that part, in the dogfights in the first one. And I just was watching this and just going, wow, you take the John Williams score and the sound effects, all that stuff, away from Star Wars. Yeah, you're left with some very interesting effects and an interestingly made movie. You don't have Star Wars. And Jaws, I think even more so, because he's just filming, he's not even filming it. He's filming barrels and he's filming swimming legs. You take away that driving score of the shark arriving and you lose 50% of the film. I mean, I really think it's as much as that. I think John Williams, wow, what a fucking score. And he won an Oscar for both of them, and rightly so.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we'll finish it there.
We'll finish it there.
For those who want to see Ashley's work, I'm going to, in the show notes for this podcast, there will be links to his Instagram and website. So info will be there. Thank you, Ashley, for the list. That's
thank you.
I can tell you love to hang out with your friends and talk about cinema. And yes, and go see, when you're here in LA, you take advantage of American Cinematheque and all the opportunities to watch classic films the way they were meant to be seen.
Yes.
Which is excellent. All right. Well, I'm gonna get us out of here, because sadly I have run out of time myself. So let me just say thank you, Ashley Cahill, for taking the time to do this. And everyone for listening, thank you so much. If you want to learn more about this podcast or the TV series that was born out of it, just go to discoverindiefilm.com. It's at DIF Wins. Yeah, I forgot to say the first podcast, because I always forget this, but you should be a nice person and like and subscribe. Give things 5 stars. Hell, you should go to IMDb and give all Ashley's films a 9 out of 10. Just do it. Make up for the trolls.
Yes. Yeah.
Lord knows, nothing makes me angrier than seeing quality films like get dragged down by people who are never meant to see them. But anyway.
Right.
And I met Ashley through the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, where his film First Person, a film about love, won 4 awards, which I won't rattle off. I think I did it in the beginning. If you want to learn more about that festival, go to ShermanOaksFF.com, and it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. Sherman Oaks Film Festival has a sister festival every June. That's Film Invasion Los Angeles. Just go to FilmInvasionLA.com, and it's at FilmInvasionLA on social media. And thanks again, Ash.
Thank you.